Robots Radio presents...
In 1939, director John Ford and star John Wayne rumbled their rootin' tootin' way into the hearts of the American public.
In 2019, we return to Ireland to try its best-selling whiskey.
The movie is Stagecoach.
The whiskey is Jameson.
And we'll review them both. This is...
The Film and Whiskey Podcast. Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And this week, we are continuing our tour through 1939 films with the Western classic, Stagecoach. Brad, welcome back to the year 1939. You know, we just came off of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and now we're in the realm of the Western. Had you ever seen the movie Stagecoach before this viewing?
Robert, I have seen the movie Stagecoach
before this
viewing.
This is in the minority of films.
Hey, man, I am a cultured gentleman. Thank you very much, you swine.
Well, I remember that you said when we first started this podcast that Westerns were a genre that you were familiar with. And we really haven't, I don't know if we've done any true Westerns since we started the podcast. Jesse James kind of was, but not really. So I'm really excited to hear what your thoughts are on this movie. And I guess the best way for us to do that is just to jump right in with our favorite segment, Brad Explains.
Stagecoach is a movie about a group of travelers. Honestly, this movie kind of reminds me of like the Canterbury Tales. You know, you have all these random people that are traveling together. They all have their own agendas. They all have their own interests, but they've kind of bonded together over the fact that there is this Indian leader named Geronimo, who is leading part of the Apache tribe to, you know, terrorize travelers. And so it's about them trying to make their way to Lordstown. And they each have their own reasons for going. You know, John Wayne is an escaped convict. Dr. Boone has been thrown out of the city they start in because he's a drunk and he's not a good doctor. Dallas is being thrown out because she's a prostitute. Mrs. Mallory is trying to find her husband. You know, all these people are going for all sorts of different reasons, but you slowly see them bond over the shared experience of escaping an Indian attack. And it's a really amazing movie in so many different ways. And I'm really excited to talk about it with you, Bob.
Yeah, Brad, I'm excited to get into it too. This is a really important movie in the history of movies, but especially in the Western genre. You know, John Ford is probably our most famous Western filmmaker. And what he did with the medium of cinema, you know, 20 years after this movie comes out, it's in the middle of the 1950s, and the French New Wave has kind of taken over European cinema. And all of the French filmmakers are studying John Ford's movies at a level of academic, you know, rigor that movies have never been looked at before. John Ford was looked at as like the auteur of auteurs. And honestly, he's just out here making entertaining Western movies. And I think it speaks so much to what sort of a vision John Ford has of the American West that we've like so associated the Western with him.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how John Ford kind of evolves as a director. But really, here in Stagecoach, I feel like you just get him in his prime. He spends a good amount of time with his characters, developing them, allowing them to kind of show who they are. And then you see them in this high tense, you know, chase scene that just really... I could not tear my eyes away from the screen, and I cared so much about these characters that I had only spent like an hour with, but he just does such a great job of developing characters. What did you think about his ability to spend time with them, Bob?
So, Brad, I think this is going to be the first place today where we kind of disagree, because I found that a lot of the acting in the movie was actually not that great, and that's not to say that all of the acting was bad. You know, Thomas Mitchell won an Oscar for this movie, and I think it was well-deserved. But I actually think that Ford is more successful when the characters are kind of in the background and the action set pieces kind of take over. You know, he really excels in some of the small quiet moments, but I don't know if it was just the acting or the dialogue or the way that Ford portrayed both of those things, but a lot of the talking in this movie really just kind of bored me to tears. And I was waiting and waiting for Ford to get to the interesting parts of the movie. And once we get there, and I think in some of those even smaller quiet scenes, he gets there. But when it's just like people having a conversation and it's just shot, reverse shot, I actually don't think that the movie had a ton of forward momentum in those moments.
Man, that is very surprising to me. I actually found myself to be really enjoying the dialogue in this movie. I thought it was witty. I thought it was entertaining. I thought that it moved the plot forward. Like, you kind of get what you need to know, but you also get what you need to know about the characters and their motivations. I thought he really slowly took you character by character through to help you understand who they are, what they want from, you know, this journey to Lordsburg.
Okay, so maybe this is a good place to kind of get into some of the acting and the writing then, because I feel like this is kind of coming up a little bit in our conversation. I liked what they did with the characters. I thought that having such a collection of characters from such vastly different backgrounds was really well thought out. I thought that their interactions with each other were really well thought out. The way that some of them change their attitudes, some of them don't, the way that there's these social dynamics at play. It was just, I think for me, it was especially in those early scenes where they're all kind of overacting. You know, I'm thinking especially of this one scene where John Wayne's character, the Ringo Kid, has followed everybody else into this house that they're staying at, and they're eating dinner, and Mrs. Mallory, who is this, you know, esteemed, respectful lady, is being given kind of the royal treatment and given a chair to sit in, and everyone is ignoring Dallas, who is a prostitute, because they don't think that she's worthy of their time. And John Wayne is smitten. Every time somebody gives Mrs. Mallory a cup of water, you know, John Wayne asks, "What about the other lady?" And the very first time he does that is in this dinner scene. And it's a great moment in the movie, but I feel like John Ford, a couple times in the movie, he just like overemphasizes things, because John Wayne says, "What about the other lady?" And they cut to Claire Trevor, who plays Dallas. They cut to her face, and it's this like really delayed reaction shot. We have this silent shot of her, and then her reacting to John Wayne, acknowledging her and going, "Oh," and then the camera stays on her for like another 4 seconds, and there's no dialogue. It's just like, it's almost like John Ford was still making silent films. And I was really shocked watching this movie at how primitive some of this seemed, because John Ford was such a sophisticated movie maker. And like a year after this, he makes The Grapes of Wrath, which is a movie we'll watch at some point. And I just think that his direction in that movie is so much better than in this movie.
May I find you another place, Mrs. Mallory? It's cooler by the window.
Thank you.
Looks like I got the plague, don't it?
No, it's not you.
Well, I guess you can't break out of prison and into society in the same week.
Please. Please.
So I think for me, it's this weird combination of like, is it the acting or is it the writing or is it John Ford kind of making his actors do these big exaggerated things? I'm thinking especially of Hatfield, the gambler, and he's played really well by John Carradine, but I feel like his first few scenes, you know, he's like mustache twirling and flinging his cloak around. It's like this really over the top performance for a while until the movie kind of settles in. And I can't help but think that maybe John Ford is the reason that the movie had trouble getting off the ground for me.
Yeah, that's just so interesting for me. I guess part of it is that I'm so used to Western movies where a lot of the acting is over the top. I mean, you have people chewing scenery left and right in so many of these movies. And so many of these movies have John Wayne in them. To me, it felt like a familiar old friend giving me a hug. You know what I mean? Like it just made sense to me that Andy Devine is just going, "Oh, shucks, I can't believe I gotta go to Lawrenceburg."
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and that just didn't bother me. And I guess I wouldn't disagree with anything that you're saying, but maybe it's just because I've come to expect those types of things that they didn't detract from the movie for me in any way whatsoever.
See, I think that's actually a really great point, Brad, and you're kind of giving words to what I've been thinking. I think the fact that it felt so familiar is what did detract from it for me a little bit, because I first saw this movie when I was a teenager, and I loved it, and I still love parts of it, and I think the ending is super suspenseful. I love what John Ford does with that last showdown in Lordsburg, but watching it this time, I was really shocked at how much this movie felt like 50 other John Wayne movies, and how, like you said, you've got Andy Devine, you've got John Wayne, you've got all of these recurring players that come up time and time again in these classic Westerns. And usually, you know, you have those movies that you can set aside as like inferior, and there's a few that rise to the top. And I always thought Stagecoach was one of them. And watching it again this time, I didn't really see that much of a difference in this movie compared to like your standard John Wayne Western, at least not enough to make me think like, wow, yes, this deserves to be considered one of the, you know, five best Westerns ever. Does that make sense?
It does. I think the thing that really pushes this one over the top is that, you know, John Ford's action set piece at the end, you know, the chase scene before there were ever any real chase scenes, that is just so suspenseful and really is one of the best action scenes in any Western I've ever watched. So I really think that is what pulls the rest of this movie above most of other Westerns.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And maybe it's a good time to talk about that chase sequence, because it really is like the action set piece of the movie. This movie's only like 96 minutes long. And for some reason in my mind, I had thought that there was more than one shootout, more than one chase sequence. And maybe I had been confusing it with the multiple shootouts in Treasure of the Sierra Madre. But when the chase scene actually finally happened, it was like, you know, an hour and 10 minutes into the movie. And I'm like, wow, this is really late for this to be happening if this is only the first of many chases. And it really does, though, Brad. The movie hinges on it. And I think it does a pretty good job of building up to it. But for me, I do kind of wonder if we needed to have so much build up to that one action sequence. Did you find that it was a little tedious getting to that point, or did you think it worked?
I really enjoyed it. I had no problems with it. You know, there's a little bit of comic relief with, you know, the Hispanic innkeeper that has his wife run away with his horse. And so like stuff like that, I think, kind of kept the movie fresh, and it kind of relieved some of the tension. And it was in those moments that you were able to kind of pause and continue to learn more about the characters. And I think that the reason that that action scene is so tense isn't just because John Ford is a great cinematographer. You know, obviously that scene is well shot, but what really makes that scene tense is that I actually care about those characters. I care about them getting to Lordsburg. So there's something about that scene that I feel like you need that hour of character development that Ford gives you.
So you made a really good point about the cinematography in this movie, and I do think, for the most part, it really is beautiful. You get those wonderful shots of Monument Valley that John Ford is known for, and Ford and his cinematographer, Burt Glennon, really do a great job, especially the nighttime scenes at the end of the movie. It's really hard to film at night, and especially on, you know, in 1939, to have this sort of stark black and white imagery where everything is coming out of the darkness. It really was ahead of its time. And one of the things that Stagecoach has become known for in cinema history is that 2 years later, Orson Welles is given a contract at RKO to make any sort of a movie he wants, and he's never made a movie before. And he sits down with his cinematographer, Greg Toland, and they're about to make this movie called Citizen Kane. And they watch the movie Stagecoach like 30 times through over the course of filming Citizen Kane, because Orson Welles thought that this movie was like a textbook on how to make a movie, from going from wide shots to close-ups to medium shots, how to move things from the left to the right on the screen, how to follow the line of action. He really thought that John Ford's filmmaking in Stagecoach is what taught him how to make Citizen Kane.
I mean, who am I to argue with the master? He's clearly making a perfect movie here.
Yeah, and I think that it makes me feel even more outnumbered that I didn't enjoy it as much this time through. And now I'm arguing against Citizen Kane and you.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious which one carries more weight, but the important thing, Bob, to remember is that, like, just because you didn't enjoy it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad movie. There's a lot of movies out there that, you know, we're allowed to recognize, hey, this is, like, technically brilliant, but I didn't enjoy it. I mean, we literally started the podcast with that exact argument being given by me about Goodfellas.
Yeah, and the thing is, I do still enjoy this movie. I think that was the hardest thing for me is going back to my IMDb and changing my score because I had had it at a 10 from when I had last seen it. And so I'm not going to get into my final score yet, but it is a movie that I have enjoyed for so long. And I think that my memory of it was just that it was this knockout movie that was nearly perfect. And I just didn't quite get that this time around. But Brad, I think you're right. You know, it's okay to disagree with the popular vote on a movie. So real quick, Brad, before we get into our whiskey segment, I want to just kind of go through the cast because this cast is incredible and they're given really, really great characters to portray. We've talked a little bit about John Wayne, but let's go a little bit deeper on John Wayne in this movie. This was kind of considered his big breakout or comeback role. He had been in a movie in 1930 called The Big Trail. And it was a huge budget Western movie. You know, sometime if you're ever bored, you should go look at this, Google The Big Trail. It was a huge financial flop. It lost so much money. And John Wayne was basically relegated to making B-movies throughout the 1930s. He had made a really good friendship with John Ford. And Ford basically told him, like, I'm not putting you in any of my movies until you can prove to me that you're a good actor because of what happened on The Big Trail. And so when he gets to Stagecoach, Ford gives him this part of the Ringo Kid. And I've always loved that iconic, famous shot where you first see John Wayne when he kind of, you know, hails the Stagecoach by shooting around at it. And you get this awesome dolly all the way in to a close-up on his face. I've always just seen that as like Ford announcing to the world, like, here he is. Here's the next big thing. It's John Wayne. And I think that he owns this role better than almost any role that I've seen him in.
Yeah, I mean, if I think about John Wayne, that picture of him right when he hails the Stagecoach is like how I remember John Wayne. You know, and like the thing is, I've seen him in so many other movies, but for some reason, that young, fresh-faced, eager look in his eyes is just captivating. And I absolutely love the way John Wayne not only enters this movie, but I really think he carries the movie. And I think I would probably agree with you that the movie drags a little bit until John Wayne gets on the screen. You know, he just has this sense of urgency to the way he moves, to the way he talks. You know, and I think this is a trademark about John Wayne, is that he's not a man who wastes anything. Every single line he delivers is deliberate. The way he walks, the way he talks, it has a weight to it that says, you know, I am important and what I am doing is nobody will stop me. And so I just love the way John Wayne moves us through this movie.
Oh, he's magnetic. But what I kind of love about this performance, Brad, is in some ways that he hasn't quite become all caps John Wayne yet. John Wayne became one of those people towards the end of his career that he didn't even really act anymore. He just showed up and was John Wayne and they made a movie about right. It. You know, it's kind of like Pacino now. Like, he has become a caricature of himself in a lot of ways. And what I love about John Wayne in this movie is he was never the world's most talented actor. He never had that much of a range. And I think it really works to his advantage in this movie because he's playing kind of this doe-eyed, naive. Yes, he's an outlaw in some ways, but he comes across as a kid. He comes across as fairly innocent. And I think it works really, really well for John Wayne's skill set as an actor. And it works in a way that his later roles didn't work because a 50, 60-year-old man can't convincingly play young and naive anymore. And so I think that's why I love this role so much for him.
Yeah, I mean, the script itself kind of gives it away how naive he is. You know, Doc asks him at one point, you know, how old were you when you got put away? And he kind of like ponders for a second, goes, I don't know, 17? And so you kind of get this understanding that he's still a 17-year-old kid who just got out of prison when he's 26 or 27. And so you kind of understand that, man, like, he hasn't really seen the world. He doesn't know what a prostitute is. And he asks her to marry him. And, like, it's just, I would agree with you, Bob. His young, fresh eagerness is what makes this character so compelling.
So, Brad, I want us to focus in just really briefly on the rest of the cast, and we're not going to do it justice because there's so many great performances, and that's one of the things this movie is remembered for, is being such a great ensemble movie. But if you had to single out just one person, who would you want to talk about as kind of your MVP for the movie, aside from John Wayne?
Oh, man.
It's a tough question, isn't it?
Yeah, man, this is really hard. I mean, you can talk about Claire Trevor as Dallas. You can talk about Thomas Mitchell as Doc Boone. I think that Louise Platt as, you know, Mrs. Mallory, I think she brought kind of a quiet dignity to the movie. There's so many people in this movie. You know what, Bob? I'm just going to leave this one up to you. I really don't know who I want to talk about.
Well, then I'm going to cheat, and I think we should talk about two people. I think that we have to at least mention Thomas Mitchell. He was in our movie last week, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and he was fantastic in that movie. He's in this movie, and he's going to be on the podcast in 2 weeks when we do Gone with the Wind. All of these performances happened in 1939, and he also had another big movie that came out in 39 that we're not going to be covering, but he actually won the Oscar for this movie. And it's even more impressive when you think about the fact that there were so many Thomas Mitchell performances in this year to choose from that this is the one that got nominated, and it carried him all the way to the Oscar. I thought that he was really, really great in this movie. And we've talked a little bit about how some of the performances are over the top. And I found that his Doc Boone really grounded the movie. Like, yes, he has a couple scenes early on where he's playing it for laughs with his drunkenness, but he's the one that actually brings some seriousness to the role. There's this great scene where right after Mrs. Mallory has delivered her baby, Dallas is talking to Doc in the hallway and asking his advice about what to do with John Wayne's love for her. It gets really serious, and it adds a layer of emotion to the movie that up to that point, I don't feel like the movie had. And it solely relies on Thomas Mitchell being able to sell that moment.
Ringo asked me to marry him. Is that wrong for a girl like me? If a man and woman love each other, it's all right, ain't it, Doc?
You're going to be hurt, child. Worse than you've ever been hurt. Don't you know that boy's headed back for prison? Besides, if you two go in the Lordsburg together, he's got to know all about you.
He's not going into Lordsburg. All I want is for you to tell me it's all right.
Gosh, child, who am I to tell you what's right or wrong? All right. Go ahead. Do it if you can. Good luck.
That would probably be one of the most important scenes of the movie for me. And I love the line where he just flat out says, he goes, oh, who am I to tell you what's right or wrong? You know, and you kind of get this almost introspective glance into his soul where, like, he recognizes the problems that he has, that, you know, he's seen so much and he's a drunkard and, you know, he's probably not the best doctor in the world. And so you kind of get this introspective glance into his soul, and he just says, look, like, I can't tell you anything about that. And it's very revealing, and you kind of understand who he is as a person.
He really is great. And then the other person that I think really stood out to me was Claire Trevor as Dallas. In the credits for this movie, Claire Trevor is actually listed above John Wayne because she was a bigger star at this point. And she really hasn't survived, you know, the last 80 years as a huge Hollywood star that we remember. But I really, really loved what she did with the character of Dallas because, again, she grounded her. And she played that character of the sort of put upon outcast prostitute in a way that wasn't drawing attention to itself. And in a movie full of people drawing attention to themselves, I was really pleasantly surprised with how much she got some subtlety across with her performance.
Yeah, out of everybody in this movie, I really think that her acting performance might have been the best. She really just conveys a depth of character to herself, you know, and she kind of creates a trope, you know, of like, you know, the prostitute with a heart of gold. And she creates this identity, and you really care about her as a person. I was blown away with her performance.
One piece of trivia, Brad. Did you notice who played the young cavalry lieutenant that saw them off on their journey at the crossroads, that waved goodbye to the stagecoach as they went on from the army?
Why, yes, I did, Bob. He is a young Tim Holt, our friend from the Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
It is a beardless Tim Holt, and he looks very weird once you're used to seeing him with a beard, doesn't he?
Yeah, yes, I literally saw him, and I was like, huh, he looks kind of familiar. And then he talked, and I was like, oh, I've heard that voice before. And it kind of took me a few minutes, but I finally realized, I was like, oh, he's from the Treasure of the Sierra Madre. That's Tim Holt.
The beard really works for him. He really should have stuck to a beard more often.
Oh, for sure.
Well, Brad, we have a lot more to talk about with Stagecoach, but what do you say we take a break at this point and get into this Jameson Irish whiskey?
Bob, I'm super pumped for this. Jameson is like one of the earliest whiskeys that I like fell in love with. So I'm really happy that we're finally getting into it on the podcast.
Let's do it. All right. So today we are drinking Jameson Irish whiskey. Brad, it is kind of refreshing to be able to do a whiskey that's so popular, because I don't really feel like we even need to do any backstory on this. If you've had whiskey before, chances are you've had Jameson.
Yeah. So you know how like when you go to the bar, it's good to just have like that one drink that you can order no matter who you're with, or if you just want something to sip on and you don't want to look like an idiot because you don't, you know how to order some fancy drink. There's like that one drink you have to have. And for me, from the very beginning, it has been a Jameson and ginger.
Yeah, it's a classic cocktail. And it almost feels like you shouldn't call it a cocktail because it's so simple, but it's such a great mixer and it never disappoints. And I think that's kind of why I'm excited to get into drinking Jameson, because it's not often that I drink it, you know, neat or straight and not cut with something. So why don't we do it? Brad, what are you picking up on the nose of Jameson?
Smoothness. Like when I think about Irish whiskeys, this is what I think about. It's smooth. You know, there's slight fruity hints to it. It's not overpowering. It's a very subtle whiskey.
I think that I formed an opinion on Irish whiskey too soon in the course of this podcast because, you know, we tried Tullamore Dew, and the word that we kept using for Irish whiskey after that was bright, because it just smelled very subtle, very light. And then we tried Redbreast, and we started to get these sort of darker, I don't want to say smokier, but earthier notes. And yeah. I'm really, really impressed with Jameson because it has those same notes that we found and we loved in Redbreast, but I mean, you know, and again, spoiler alert, Jameson's like $24. Redbreast was $60-something. So the fact that it has this much complexity on the nose and this much character to it, I'm really impressed with this. I'm picking up a lot of like a yeasty bread. It has a really bready smell to me, almost like a pretzel, like a sourdough pretzel. Yeah. And I kind of love that. It's not sweet, and that's okay because I can tell that this whiskey has some character to it.
Yeah, I would totally agree, Bob. I think I'm going to give this an 8 on the nose. It's not overpowering. The ethanol doesn't punch you in the nostril or anything. It's a really pleasant, earthy, smooth whiskey.
Yeah, I'm also going to give it an 8 on the nose. Like you said, there's definitely some subtle fruit on this, but again, it's kind of a dark, almost like a dark cherry smell that I get on this. And then there's something else in this that I can't quite place. It's almost like a licorice smell, like an anise or something like that. But it all works together really, really well. I'm going to give it an 8 on the nose. All right, so Brad, what do you say we give it a sip? Oh, man, that's good. It's got this really nice, not smoky. What's the word? I guess I would call it like malty. It has this malty, almost scotch-like taste to it. But the thing I love about it is that the sweetness that's there stays with you through to the finish. It doesn't dry out. It doesn't get bitter. It's just really pleasant to drink this.
Bob, I'm not going to lie to you. I have already been drinking this since the start of the episode. And I will tell you this, my friend. It gets better and better as you go. Like this flavor profile, it has this sweetness that isn't, it's not fake in any way. It kind of reminds me of like honey. I really liked that you said dark cherry earlier, because it does have kind of that darkness to it that draws it into being a much more complex whiskey than I might have thought, just looking at its price tag and the fact that it's so mass produced.
Yeah, that's the thing that's really shocking me. You know, we split a while back talking about Chivas Regal, which I thought was a really good mass produced whiskey, and you didn't, clearly. But with Jameson, I mean, we're talking about what is far and away the world's best-selling Irish whiskey. This thing is produced on such a massive scale. And I really, really am shocked at how much complexity is going on in the flavor profile of this for something that you can pick up at any store for $20.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it. Literally any liquor store in the country, you can get this stuff for a cheap price. I'm going to give this an 8 on its taste as well.
I'm going to take it down just a little bit. You know, I talked about how the sweetness lingers on the finish, and it does, but after you kind of let the finish dissipate a little bit, some of those bitter flavors start to come back up just a tad. I'm going to give it a 7 on the taste, and I'll jump right into finish. I'm going to give it a 7.5 on the finish. I'm really pleasantly surprised by what this is able to do, how long lasting the finish is. I don't like some of these bitter notes that are kind of creeping back up, but I'll still give it a 7.5 on the finish.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and give it a 7.5 on the finish as well. I think that there's something about this whiskey that there is a little bit left to be desired at the end of it. You know, it's a very thin whiskey, and so it doesn't sit on your palate for very long, which could be a good thing, could be a bad thing. You know, it depends on what you want out of your whiskey. But yeah, I'm going to give it a 7.5 on the finish.
All right, so that takes us to balance. Now, this is where we kind of compare the nose, the taste, and the finish all in relation to each other. A lower score means that something stuck out in a bad way, or, you know, it teased us with the nose and then it didn't have anything on the flavor. I'm not getting that at all on this whiskey. I think that it was really consistent throughout. The only thing that I would take away from it is that a little bit of a letdown on the finish, but I think I'm going to give it an 8 on overall balance.
I am going to give it an 8 as well. This is an extremely well-balanced whiskey. You know what you're getting into, and you know where you're going with it. It's so well made.
So that takes us to value. In the state of Ohio, a fifth of Jameson will cost you $24.99, which is a very reasonable price, especially in relation to the Redbreast that we did just a few weeks ago on the podcast. So Brad, at a $25 price point for a fifth, what kind of a score would you give this on value?
Bob, I'm going to give this a 9.5. I can't imagine a company doing much better of a job of putting a price point on it on their whiskey.
Brad, I think you're pretty much spot on. And this is where I struggle with the value category, because are we scoring it only in the category of Irish whiskeys? Are we scoring it across the broad spectrum of whiskeys? And I think there's probably still a few bourbons that we can get for cheaper than this that I would choose over this. But this is definitely the best value I've seen in an Irish whiskey ever so far on the podcast. So I'm going to give it an 8.5. You know, it's a really good value, especially for Irish whiskey. I do think there are a couple other different varieties of whiskey that have better values at lower price points, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm just really impressed with this overall. But I think 8.5 is a very reasonable score to give.
So that puts me out to a 39 out of 50. This is one of our higher scoring whiskeys. And again, it's because we factor value into the mix. And an 8.5 is nothing to sneeze at. This is a really solid whiskey at a really reasonable price.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if you look at our tasting scores for Redbreast and you compared them to just the tasting scores for Jameson, we'd come out to very similar numbers. But the reason that my score came out to a 41 out of 50 for Jameson and it did not come out that high for Redbreast is because of price. You know, so I would say you're getting a comparable whiskey as far as what you're drinking for a much, much better price.
Yeah, in terms of quality, I would say this is at least 75 to 80% as good as Redbreast. And you're getting, I mean, you could literally get two bottles of this and have money left over for what it would cost you to get one bottle of Redbreast 12.
Yeah, which it just blows my mind. Like, is it a little bit better? Sure. But I am going to buy Jameson over and over and over again.
So, Brad, what does that put you out to?
A 41 out of 50, Bob.
So I'm at a 39. That averages us out to a 40 out of 50 or an 80 out of 100. This is in the top 20% of whiskeys. And I'm not ashamed to say that. You know, part of what we do on this podcast is recommend whiskeys the way that we would recommend them to a friend. And this is one that if you don't have a bottle of this on your shelf, you absolutely need to go out and buy it, because not only is it affordable, but it is a respectable whiskey on top of that.
And the beautiful thing is, I will bet you that our listener down in Montevideo could probably find themselves a bottle of Jameson.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the beauty of it. It's internationally distributed. We can all lift a glass of Jameson together and toast what is probably the most pleasantly surprising whiskey I have had on this podcast.
Well, that was a ringing endorsement from Mr. Book. But Bob, what do you say about getting back to talking about some Stagecoach?
Let's do it. All right, so that was Jameson Irish Whiskey. Brad, what do you say we get back into talking about Stagecoach by way of our maybe favorite segment? And that segment is Hot Takes.
Bob, I'm excited because for the first time in the history of the Film and Whiskey podcast, I will be reading one of our Hot Takes.
Oh, I can't wait, man. Hot Takes is where we read one-star reviews of these classic movies and see whether or not we agree with them. So, Brad, why don't you hit us with our first Hot Take?
All right, Bob, I'm super excited to bring you our very first Hot Take of the day. You know, this one comes from an IMDb user named OnePotato2, and his take is about as simplistic as his name, and it is titled, Unwatchably Dated. While I like other Wayne and Ford movies, this is unwatchable. This is my second try. I cannot imagine why people would offer a rave for this, except if one's sense organs were shut off completely and the movie was evaluated abstractly, i.e., the movie that produced all the cliches of the Western must deserve some special praise. But the praise is one level removed. A viewer has to ignore the natural tedium that pungently outdated ideas smother you with, and endure cliche after cliche accumulating. Sure, they weren't cliches at the time, but they're dry, crusty ancestors of cliches now. As entertainment, this is quite unwatchable. You could play memes of the 1930s bingo watching this. Hooker with a heart of gold? Check. Unconvincing exterior gunfight shot inside a studio? Yep. As always in 1930s movies, the score mercilessly pounds one theme into your brain over and over. And over, and over, and over. I find I can only go back to about 1939 in terms of film viewership before I can't detect a representation of the world commensurate with modern ideas and values. One star.
All right, hot take of hot takes. I actually don't think that was that bad of, bad of an argument for a one-star review. I don't think this is a one-star movie. But, like, I actually wrote in my notes that I thought the score to this movie was, like, unbearable.
Really?
Yeah, man. It was just, like, it was tipping us off to, like, when the Native Americans were around. It was hammering home the folk songs. I don't know, man. I think maybe I agree with a lot of this one-star review.
Man, that is interesting to me.
It's a hot take.
Hot take. Yeah, I mean, you do realize that this won the Oscar for Best Musical Score.
Yeah, over The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. What? What?
I mean, hey, I'm just saying.
All right, all right. Next hot take is from Amazon. It comes from a user known as A. Niles. And that one-star review is titled, Hated It. Hated it. I hate all John Wayne stuff. I hate John Wayne, and I don't usually wish hate on anyone, but I wish he hadn't. 1 star. That's the whole review.
Bob, I wish you hadn't.
I wish he hadn't. Also.
Hadn't what, Brad? Let's have an intellectual conversation about what you wish I hadn't done. No. I wish you hadn't.
Also, A. Niles spelled his name Jom Wayne. Jom Wayne.
Oh, man.
And that leads us to my very favorite hot take of all time. This is a 1-star review left on Amazon by a user named Lynn, the title of which is Never Seen It, and the body of the text just says Mom. 1 star.
1 star. Yeah. Like, I just kind of wonder sometimes, what was Lynn doing with her life that she decided, you know what I need to do with my precious time? I need to go on Amazon, look up the movie Stagecoach, give it a 1-star review stating that I've never seen it, and just put a random noun in the review box.
Yep. I think that's it. I think that's the whole thought process. Maybe, you know, like, I don't know if maybe she just inherited her mom's movie collection and she was trying to, like, make a database, but instead of typing it into, like, Excel or Word, she just did it in Amazon reviews.
In Amazon, yeah. This is a movie that mom gave me, as opposed to a movie with the review, Dad.
All right, so that has been Hot Takes.
Hot Takes.
All right, real quick, Brad, I do want to talk about the ending to this film, because I think that when they get the stagecoach into Lordsburg, and you know that John Wayne has this showdown coming, the movie kind of flips into almost a completely different feel or genre. It stops being like this adventure movie, and it becomes this really, really suspenseful showdown. And I think it worked really well, but it almost does seem like two completely separate movies. Did you kind of get that vibe watching it?
Yeah, Bob, I really was struck by the same thing. You know, they pull into Lordsburg, and it's a really somber scene. You know, you've had all these characters that are full of life and vigor and energy, and all of a sudden, you know, Hatfield has been killed, Buck has been injured, Curly is going to take John Wayne off into, you know, custody again. It's a really somber kind of feeling as they arrive into town. And then on top of that, you see that the Plummer brothers get word that, you know, Ringo is the kid is in town, and they're like getting ready for a shootout. And so the movie takes on a very different feel. And I don't know if I fully liked that transition in the movie. Honestly, it kind of felt like the story of Ringo Kid overtook the importance of all the other characters. You know, I feel like it might have been better if we had spent some time as the party honored Hatfield after he died. Like, if they had gone to the bar and poured one out for him. Like, there's something about that, like, it's just kind of like, oh, well, this whole thing happened, but the only person we care about is Ringo, so we're just going to focus on him now. It was a struggle for me.
Yeah, I really agree with you, Brad. I think that they could have spent some time with these characters in Lordsburg, and they try to develop the relationship between Dallas and the Ringo Kid. It's even that's in the context of, like, he's on his way to go to this showdown, and she's like, well, I guess I'll walk with you and show you where I live along the way. And it's very weird how they have to, like, shoehorn in these other things because they're so focused on getting to that showdown. And like I said, I really think that gunfight, you know, or the buildup to it is great, and it's well done, and it's suspenseful. But this movie's only an hour and a half long. It wasn't like they were really needing to cut things out. And I think that that was another place where we could have gotten just a little bit more character development. And that may have even helped raise the stakes when John Wayne does go out alone, because you would have even more of a sense of what he's fighting for, what he's trying to return to. But instead, they kind of push all that aside. And we don't even see the other characters really for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, and that was disappointing. One of the strengths of this movie is the group of adventurers that the party is together. And it just makes me really sad that at the end of the movie, they just felt like, I think you said it perfectly, they really shoehorned the other characters into Ringo's story, and they didn't need to do that.
All right, so Brad, I do think we should talk really briefly about the treatment of Native Americans in this movie. Westerns obviously are not known for portraying Native Americans in a positive light. And I think that as the years went on and Westerns became kind of the dominant American genre, you saw more and more movies where aggression towards Native Americans, racism, and hatred kind of got amped up. And I've seen Westerns where they only refer to Native Americans as savages, as sort of subhuman, you know, and they use racial slurs. This movie definitely has some of that in it. And I think every time you see a Native American on screen, the music cues you in like this ominous way that you're supposed to think this is a bad guy. But I was a little surprised that they don't really go overboard with that sort of racist impulse.
I was going to say, I honestly, as I was watching this, was kind of like, you know, the problem is when you look at the reason why they were doing what they were doing, it was because we had forced them out of their lands, put them into these, you know, internment camps. And I think that this movie did a good job of accurately portraying, like, yeah, there's Indians out there that kill our travelers. And it didn't seem to take a strong position for or against that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I don't want to dwell on it. I do think it was there. I think that there are some elements in this movie that just don't hold up 80 years later, obviously, that are kind of cringy. I think the portrayal of Native Americans is one of them. The portrayal of the Mexicans in the movie, I think, is another. But to some extent, these are the things we have to grapple with when we're watching movies that are 80 years old, and especially when those movies are portraying an even earlier time in American history. It's just something that we couldn't have recorded this podcast and not at least mention it.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those places where it's okay for us living in 2019 to grapple with issues that they weren't acknowledging back in 1939. We can still watch this movie and appreciate the great cinematography. We can appreciate the wonderful musical score and, you know, so on and so forth, while we're wrestling with the fact that, yeah, there's some questionable things that, you know, we need to be careful with.
Absolutely. Well, Brad, I think this is a really good place for us to give our final scores on the movie and say whether or not we would recommend it. You already know that I've cooled a little bit on this movie in this most recent watch, but you seem very excited about this movie. And so I want to hear, Brad, what kind of a score would you give it in light of some of these smaller nitpicks we have with it? And would you recommend?
I mean, I'll just start by saying I highly recommend this movie. The action scenes are amazing. I think that the character development is really well done. It helps you fall in love with, you know, the group. But I'm going to give this an 8.5 out of 10. I think it's a phenomenal movie. I think there's a lot to love about it. I think there are parts of it that are dated. I do think that the musical score isn't perfect the way that, you know, it won an Oscar for. But overall, this is a really good movie that I really loved, and I'm happy to give it an 8.5 out of 10.
So yeah, I definitely cooled on this movie, and I can't say that I would even consider it to be one of the best Westerns anymore. In my notes, I wrote that the ending is pretty suspenseful and it works really well. And then the next line I said, but even this isn't as good as the suspense or the buildup in High Noon. And I think that this movie in the history of films is important because of what came after it and what it inspired. But going back to it now, it just doesn't seem to hold up as well as I thought it did. And I actually came all the way down to a 7 out of 10 on this movie. I do think it's a good movie, and I would recommend it. It's definitely worthwhile. John Ford, when he gets to just be the director and have an action sequence, and he employs these awesome dolly shots throughout the movie, the camera moves beautifully. I do think it's a great sort of textbook for a movie, but it doesn't hit the highs of some other Westerns in the genre. So for me, it's a 7 out of 10.
Man, I'm really surprised by that. I kind of play a game with myself throughout the episode of like, what is Bob going to give this movie? I thought you were going to give it a 7.5 to an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I thought about a 7.5, and I think, you know, given some space, I might bump it up to a 7.5. Maybe when we do our rankings at the end of the season, Brad, it might move up a little bit. But for now, I walked away from this movie after this viewing, and the feeling that I had more than anything was just disappointment. And it just didn't seem to live up to what I had remembered it being in my mind. And I think that is definitely influencing my score.
Yeah, but in the end, Bob, I could give a rip about what you think about the movie, because Film and Whiskey Nation, I want to hear what you have to say about this movie. So please, give us your feedback on the movie Stagecoach. Have you seen it before? What kind of a score would you give it? Bob, where can they find us on social media?
They can find us on Instagram, on Twitter, or on Facebook at Film Whiskey with an E.
And you can also give us a call. We have a call-in line. Call in and, you know, tell Bob he's wrong for giving a 7 out of 10, or perhaps you'll think that an 8.5 is way too high. Our phone number is 216-800-5923. Once again, that number is 216-800-5923.
Next week, we will be back for your Thanksgiving holiday, continuing our 1939 series with the film that reminds us that there is no place like home, The Wizard of Oz. For the Film and Whiskey Podcast, I'm Bob Book.
I am Brad G.
We'll see you next time.
So I kind of forgot that a shot of alcohol is like 44, you know, milliliters.
Yeah.
And I poured out both 100 milliliter things into my glass. So I have like 4 shots of Jameson.
This is going to be a really fun episode to finish out here.
I've had like a few little sips. I didn't want to drink too much.
Yeah.
But like, I'm going to be drinking as we get along.